On the Bookshelf with your host, Dave Doc Kirby.
One of the ongoing situations to address in America continues to be race. Despite efforts made by very good people of extreme talent and courage, we still have issues with it. Is it a systemic problem? Is there a sin problem? How do we address it and how do we move beyond it? Today, to talk to us about this is Dr. George Yancey, professor at the Institute for Studies of Religion at Baylor University, where he specializes in race, ethnicity, and religion. He works to promote collaborative communications as a solution to racial unrest. His books include Compromising Scholarship, One Faith No Longer, Hostile Environment, Beyond Racial Gridlock, and Transcending Racial Barriers, and his newest book, Beyond Racial Division, A Unifying Alternative to Colorblindness and Anti-Racism. It's from InterVarsity Press. He is a graduate of West Texas State University with a B.S. in Economics, attended the University of Texas at Austin, where he received his doctorate in sociology. He began to study interracial romance, but then was fortunate enough to work with Michael Emerson on a $500,000 grant to study multiracial churches. And a few years ago, he began to study academic bias and now is conducting research on anti-Christian attitudes in the U.S. In 1999, he began teaching at the University of North Texas, and then in 2019 started working for Baylor with a joint appointment in sociology and the Institute for Studies of Religion. Dr. George Yancey, thank you so much for joining us today on The Bookshelf.
Thanks for having me.
In the book, you talk about the different ways that people have tried to address race relations in America, and a lot of different ideas, and many of them are not particularly successful. One of the ways at dealing with race relations in America is one that is apparently the one that white people tend to gravitate toward, and that is colorblindness, the idea that color shouldn't matter, we shouldn't even notice. But that's not really a very good answer either. And then we have the anti-racists, which has been a growing group. They don't have all the answers either. You say that there is a different way, and the idea is that we need this new path forward. What started you on this path? Was it your personal experience? Was it a large volume of scholarship? What started you toward this new direction?
Well, you know, I can honestly say that being a Christian, that my faith gave me the original inspiration towards looking at this, because as a Christian, you're supposed to look after the needs of others before your own.
Right.
And you understand that that we're all depraved and we all tend to be selfish. And so that gave me the basis, the background, to think of something other than what I've seen around me, which did not seem to be working, which is either trying to ignore race or a more heavy-headed approach that was backfiring, in my opinion.
Being African-American, you've sadly had plenty of firsthand opportunities to undergo racial discrimination. When you talk to white colleagues, are they always kind of surprised?
I guess one way to think about it is, I think a lot of people I talk to understand that racial problems are still here. Some may not understand to the extent that they still exist. And some of what's happened in my life, I think, you know, some people have a harder time accepting it. Not that they think I'm lying, but
right,
accepting that that really does happen, that really did happen in my life. So I think that, you know, for some whites, because they didn't have to deal with racial issues growing up, they're not as prepared when they actually hear about it.
Certainly think that's the case because, and I've heard this said before, but it's true that for white folks that race is never on the table, and for black folks, race is always on the table. We don't think about it because no one ever comes up to us and challenges our ethnicity or anything or tries to treat us differently because of it. But according to my black students, that's not their case at all, even to this day, even in what we might think are more enlightened times.
Yeah, and I think I'll make clear, you know, I'm not saying, and I think it's illogical to say that nothing has changed, things haven't gotten better. And so, to some extent, what your attitude was in the back, yeah, we are better than we used to be. But I don't think we're as good as we should be, and in some ways, we're getting worse from this point forward. So I would hope that we can find ways to do a better job with race relations and to learn how to work together rather than tear each other apart.
So tell us about this new way forward, this new path. Is this the mutual accountability model?
This has been in my mind for quite a while. And as I said, I was thinking about my Christian faith and those values and what it would mean and what would it mean if we, instead of trying to win all the time, we try to work together, compromise when necessary, figure out what's really important, what's not important, and can we give up that which is not important so that we can get support in that which is really important? So those are kind of framework by which I begin to think of what I would call a mutual accountability approach, an approach where we're all accountable to having better race relations with each other, to communicating with one another, to finding solutions, rather than trying to win out everything, to beat whoever we disagree with down. So that's what set it up. And then, you know, the more of it was just, all right, practically, how do you do that? And that's really the harder part. Hmm. How do you actually do this?
Right.
Because I think that this is what's going to work, but that doesn't mean that we know how to execute it. I think that we're so out of practice to really working with each other and finding compromises that it'll be hard. But there is some evidence in other areas that this type of collaborative conversation actually does make things better. And so we can draw on that and do our best we can, trial and error, until we can figure it out. And that's what we need to, that's the direction we need to go.
Certainly, making some progress in talking to each other is a huge step in the right direction. So let's work our way through the steps that you delineate in your book, Beyond Racial Division. The first is to define the racial problem. We need to arrive at that from a consensus and not just your way is right, your way is wrong. Okay, you win, I lose, right? That's what you're saying, is that that's far too often how we've done things in the past. We want to one-up each other. That's human nature, and that's our sin nature talking.
Yes, and we have to know what our problem really is. So a lot of times we try to create a definition of the problem that makes us automatically win. Well, what we have to do is, all right, what is the problem we're trying to deal with right now? And once we can agree upon that, then we can move forward. And I wanted that as the first step because one problem is we try to solve everything at once. And I understand that. There's a lot of things that need solving. But it's like when you're with your spouse or girlfriend or boyfriend or what have you, and you try to solve all the problems of your relationship at the same time, nothing gets solved.
Right.
So I'm much more comfortable with someone saying, okay, we have all these problems, but we're going to solve this one right now and then move on. And I think that's a much better approach to think about.
So how do we define the racial problem? Is it people are treated differently because of their ethnicity, and that continues to happen whether we pretend it doesn't or whether we ignore it or not?
Yeah, the way I would look at it is the problem in today's society, while we have people who treat each other differently by race, the problem is the lingering effects of racism more than contemporary racism. What I mean by that is we've had centuries of racial abuse, and I don't think any reasonable person disagrees with that.
Right.
We now have laws that forbid overt racism, and that's just clear. So what do we do now? Do we just say, okay, everything's okay and move on, even though those centuries of racial abuse have created problems in the communities of color? Or do we try to figure out solutions so that we can move forward? That is really where the difficulties lie. And what I advocate is the way to move forward is together, not with one group saying, here's how we're going to move forward, we're going to ignore race, and you just have to accept that. Or another group saying, here's how we're going to move together, we're going to end whiteness, and you just have to accept that. We're going to have to figure out how we can move forward together. And that is the ultimate challenge that we have right now.
And once again, this is people of goodwill sitting with each other and saying, we know we have a problem, so we've got to work on defining it, and we've got to work on finding a way forward rather than just saying, we'll never reconcile it, or this is the way it's always been. All those old excuses that got slung back and forth, this is the way it is, you just have to get used to it. Well, that obviously wasn't good enough. That obviously wasn't adequate, and it wasn't fair. So you're right, we can pass rules, we can pass laws, but we can't change hearts just by making it something legal or illegal. That's a step in the right direction, certainly, but that has not hit the core problem. So defining the core problem, defining the issues of race in America, means that we have to acknowledge that there is this long history, and it isn't just a contemporary situation. It's just like the situation, say, with the perception of police in America. Because of the historic, so many white police people have taken advantage of the badge to do terrible things to black people and get away with it. that's why there's such an uproar, and it seems like it's happened yet again. And that's what you're talking about, right? That we can't ignore the fact that we have this bad history that goes back centuries, and you can't just wipe it away in a moment.
Yeah, that's part of it. You know, that's part of it. I mean, certain stereotypes have developed, and we have to react to that. But also, and here's something to think about since you've pointed out this particular issue. All right, so why are the police more likely to be in neighborhoods of color in order for things to happen that are less than desirable? I'll just put it that way.
Okay.
Well, part of it is because how the neighborhoods have developed. And when you look at the effects of residential segregation, you know that there's a reason why black ghettos and especially barrios have a higher crime problem. Now, I'm not dismissing people who do crime. I'm not saying that they're not responsible or anything like that. So please hear me out. But obviously, when people have different opportunities, there's going to be different levels of temptation to commit crimes and to engage in violence. And so that itself creates the problem that creates a sort of police interaction that we see. So what's happened historically has also impacted the neighborhoods. Also, you can look at some of the rules that are enforced. Sometimes, and I think this was really particularly the case, was it Freddie Brown or someone, that the police are enforcing rules in some ways in order to make more money for the state and for the local government.
There are
certain nonsense crime rules that maybe we need them, but I think we have to rethink about that in light of what's happened historically, the community police relations, the effects of residential segregation, the continuing effects of discrimination. We know from research that if you're a black or a Latino and you apply for a job, you're less likely to get called back for an interview. You know, all these things matter. Now, they're not the only thing that matters, and here's where I differ from the anti-racists who will point this out too, all the stuff I point out, they'll point that out too, is that we don't just factor in those factors. We factor in other factors that perhaps European Americans want to bring into the calculation, because we've got to find a solution that we can be comfortable with.
Right.
Rather than find a solution that say, here's what I see, and because I see this, I'm going to impose this on you.
These issues didn't just arise overnight, and things like redlining exacerbated the situations in the inner city, for example. It really hasn't been all that long ago that redlining ceased to be a factor in cities, and maybe even it's still going on in certain places that it just hasn't been uncovered yet. These are the things that have to be understood in light of trying to find a way forward.
That's part of why I think the conversation is so important, because one of the things is we don't always understand where people are coming from. And so a white person doesn't understand why people of color may feel the way that they do and some of the problems that they have to deal with. I understand, as an African-American, that sometimes I may not understand the position whites may be placed themselves into. And that's not to say that these problems are equal, but if I don't understand where a white person is coming from, how can I have the sort of dialogue that we can find a solution? So part of it is understanding as well as having a productive conversation where we can find solutions to our problems.
We're talking, in case you're just joining us, to Dr. George Yancey, the author of Beyond Racial Division, A Unifying Alternative to Colorblindness and Anti-Racism. It's from InterVarsity Press in paperback. And the mutual accountability model is what Dr. Yancey is saying as a Christian, that this gives us a way to dialogue and figure things out together and not just have one side versus another side. The second thing that you talk about is identifying our commonalities. If we are both Christians, that gives us a much bigger commonality than any sort of difference in our appearance or our upbringing or anything like that.
I do think our Christian commonality helps us, but it's not enough. Because how we define our Christian commonality can vary so much. And that's part of the reason why we need to figure it out. We know that how black churches conduct themselves tend to be different from how white churches conduct themselves. Now, in the real core issues, of course, there's agreement. But in what is emphasized and what is preached, there's a lot of differences. And so we need to understand that. We can't rely on just our Christian commonality in order to have the unity that we need.
All right. So do we talk about then the commonality of our humanity, what it's like to be a person, what it's like to have certain types of emotions. So that's really the place we start with finding out our commonalities, or am I getting too broad?
It is a little broad. You know, I think, you know, we have commonality. I mean, as Christians, commonality, that's a good thing. You know, I just don't want us to end there.
Right, right.
So when I critique, you know, we got to be careful with that. It's that I think sometimes Christians think, well, we're all Christians, therefore that's enough, and we get in there. So humanity would be the same thing. You know, I think that's great. You know, we do need to think about how we as humans have similar problems, similar struggles, similar whatever. But we can't end there.
Right.
That's not sufficient.
We also have to, and you have as point three, is recognize our cultural and racial differences. And, you know, the interesting thing, the white side of it is, when people came here from the old countries, whatever the old countries were, the big emphasis was on assimilation. I have ancestry in Scottish roots, Irish roots, Norwegian roots, Alsatian roots. And of all those different families, none of the old traditions or anything was really transferred. We didn't learn. Nowadays, it's more common for there to be the Highland Games and things like that. But when I was growing up, just because your grandfather or great-grandfather or whatever came from Ireland didn't mean you spoke with a brogue or could dance a jig or something. Those were supposed to be subsumed by becoming an American. African Americans, up to a certain point, didn't come here voluntarily and were forced to put aside all of the old identifiers, and the family ties were deliberately shattered during slavery and so forth. So I can see that's a much bigger issue to handle. We do need to understand each other better. I mean, that's still what we're talking about, isn't it? To figure out, what's it like to be the other? What's it like to have gone through these indignities and dangers because of your ethnicity?
Yeah, African Americans are a unique group. I don't say this just because I am an African American, but whereas, you know, when you're talking about immigrant groups, there's a certain amount of choice. And
right.
For African Americans and Native Americans, there hasn't been.
Right.
Also, African Americans, because of the way that we were defined historically, was what's been called the one drop rule. I don't know if you're
right.
Familiar with that.
Yes.
You have one drop of black blood, you're black.
Right.
That sort of notion. Well, that makes it really hard to assimilate, because you can't assimilate your kids.
Right.
If you're a Native American and you have kids with a white person, that kid is kind of half white. Or you have kids with a black person. If you're white, you have kids with a black person, that person is all black. That's why we tend to assume
that. Gotcha.
So assimilation was really, there were barriers, not necessarily within the black community, but outside the black community, that really prevented assimilation for a long time. And now, that's been prevented for a long time, there's a certain inertia that makes it difficult now for that assimilation to take place.
Hmm.
So, you know, that's just one of the things that you learn as you dive into racial issues, that what you think might be the same for even all minority groups is not.
Right.
And when you look at dynamics of assimilation, and of course, when you refer to some of your European ethnic groups, they too, at one point, were a minority group that was mistreated.
Right.
And we don't forget that either. And so that brings up other questions as to, well, what happened that they're no longer in that position, and is that dynamic that's happening today, and things of this nature. So, it's really fascinating once you start getting into this, but From my point of view, I also want to be very practical about it and try to understand how we can overcome our differences to find solutions.
The fourth step that you are recommending is that it creates solutions that answer the concerns of the racial outgroup. And this is talking about driving while black and things like that, right? The situations that,
yes,
that white people never have to worry about facing, that apparently black people have to deal with facing on a pretty regular basis.
Yeah, so if we're dealing with a certain racial problem and people have, you know, talked to each other and understand each other, one thing I want to challenge people is try to think about other people's point of view as you try to construct a solution. And I would ask this of people of color, too, because the mutual responsibility approach is that everyone has to try to think of others and try to work towards a solution that we can all live with. So if, for example, if we're looking at policing in the community, I think that people of color who live in those communities have a right for, you know, the police, who I think the police of the other side, to consider what they need from those police. But I also recognize that the police have a right to make demands or make requests of people of color in those communities because they won't go home at night. I mean, policing can be a dangerous business. And so we got to try to find solutions that we can all live with. No one group gets to say everything. We all have to work together to find solutions.
I think the fifth step in this really is building, of course, everything is building on that which came before, but something that you mentioned earlier, this is exactly what you're talking about here, to find a compromise solution that works best for everybody, which means that not everybody's going to be completely and totally happy with every single aspect of it. But the point is not to make everybody happy. The point is to try to be fair and to try to work our way forward and realizing that it's not a question of who gets to win the argument.
Right, yeah. So to me, the ideal solution is going to be one where everyone is able to keep that which is really important to them and everyone finds solutions that they could all live with. And if we do that, then we can find a solution where everyone is working together to solve the problem. And whatever solution we decide on, we're all working to make it successful. If your side wins completely and can do whatever they want, the other side, whoever they may be, has no incentive to work with you. And their incentive actually is to try to work against you to find ways of sabotaging the solution. So to me, the best possible world is where we find win-win solution instead of win-lose solution.
Right.
It's not good if we win and you lose, you feel like you've lost.
Yeah.
You should feel like you've won, you know, maybe what you've won. And I'm, to be very honest, I think the solution we're going to find are going to probably, on the surface, seem to favor people of color more than whites because of our history of racial oppression and such. But we still can find solutions where people don't feel like the people of color have won everything and whites get nothing out of it. As a person of color, I have to recognize that that is not the way forward because I'm creating the resentment that's going to build up and it's going to come back and bite us at some future date.
And that's a critical component, that it needs to be a compromise that feels equally beneficial and doesn't put all the blame on one group or all the onus for change or all the responsibility for policing on one side of it, but this is a mutual sort of thing. You had an interesting thing here, the idea of going through a church split. You've been in church for a while. The odds are either you've been through one or you know of friends who've been through one, and it's never happy, and there certainly are ways that you could avoid it. This kind of approach sounds to me like it would really be a very workable solution in a lot of interpersonal conflict areas, conflict resolution. As a matter of fact, I'm going to get a copy of your book to give to one of my friends who teaches communication classes, and one of the classes she teaches is conflict management, and another one that she teaches is race relations. I'm thinking she's going to get a lot of good out of this book. Am I correct in understanding that that's how this can work? The idea, the goal is to find a way forward where everybody can at least feel like somebody's listening to the issues we've been having to deal with, and so we're listening to each other.
Yeah, I think it's critically important that everyone feels heard. And, you know, people of color for the longest time have rightly complained that no one listens to them and their complaints, rightly complain about that. But I fear sometimes when you read stuff such as white fragility and such, that there's a now attempt to make sure that whites are not heard. And I think that's a mistake. Everyone has to be heard. Everyone has to be at the table. And then we have to figure out things together. I think that is critically important. So, I hope you can give some copies of the book to those key people. Do what they have to say.
George, this is a very big topic that we've tried to handle in a very short amount of time. Is there anything else that you really want, a point that you really wanted to make that I just did not think about asking you? This is your opportunity to say, let's make sure that this gets said.
I think that this covers, the general aspect. I know in my book I try to be very practical of as far as steps people can take towards thinking on this. So I try, I'm an academic, so it's easy for me to be very theoretical. But I try, at least in the latter parts of this book, to be pretty practical as well.
Well, I think it's really an excellent plan, and I think it can work. I don't think it's just an academic solution. I think this is a real-world solution. I think this is a plan that needs to get shared with as many people as possible, and that's why I really was delighted that we were able to work out time to get a chance to talk to each other. I want to thank you very much. And also, do you have websites and other social media that you would like to mention so that people can find out more information about you and about the book and about the new way forward?
Well, my own personal website is georgeyancey.com, and it's Yancey, Y-A-N-C-E-Y. And be sure to include the E, because there's another George Yancey, believe it or not,
right,
who does not have an E in the name, and it's not me.
Okay.
But yeah, I mean, from there, you can contact me and find out other things I'm doing.
Sir, we thank you very much for making time to talk to us today on the bookshelf and for the really great ideas that you have presented in your book, Beyond Racial Division, Mutual Accountability, Way Forward That Needs to Be Tried, and the sooner we get busy with it, the better. Thank you again for making time to talk to me.
Thank you. All right, God bless.
We've been talking to George Yancey, the author of Beyond Racial Division, a unifying alternative to colorblindness and anti-racism. It's something he calls mutual accountability. It's a pretty smart idea. It's from IVP, that's InterVarsity Press. And you can go to their website, ibpress.com. You can go to his website, George Yancey, and that's with an E-Y, .com, to find out more. Until next time, I'm your host, Dave Doc Kirby. Thanks so much for listening, and God bless.